I want to begin a series of lessons on the minor prophets. The 12 of them, as you already know, of course. And I remember back in 82, the year I began here, the next year, I studied them each Sunday night. But I'd go through the whole thing, just give you an idea of what was in it. Just 12 lessons on them. This time I want to spend more time, go through and study them more in detail. In studying the minor prophets, I taught them, of course, in college for several years. I don't believe it fits in so well there as it does at the earlier period. So I'm going to begin with Obadiah, about 800 and anywhere from 45. I put in one group, and we'll deal with these first. Then in the next group comes in the 755, Amos, and then Hosea and Micah. And then after that we have Zephaniah, Nahum, and Haggai there, and then River there. So this is Edom to the south. That's called the Arabah. 612 feet below sea level here at the Dead Sea, that it rises up to a few hundred feet above sea level and drops down here to the Gulf of Aqaba. The mountain that extended across here was Mount Seir. That was the mountain to Edom that Zion was to Jerusalem. So, and this book is a judgment against the Edomites. Now, of course, you remember that Esau was the twin brother of Jacob. And the Edomites are descendants of Esau. So from the very beginning, when Esau sold his birthright and Jacob deceived him, there was enmity between the brothers, which they seemed to have made up when Jacob came back from Padan Aram. They seemed to have got along for a while because they separated and they didn't see each other very often. But the two nations, Israel and Judah, that developed from the two men, were always at enmity one with the other. And Jacob was the more spiritual with all of his faults. Esau was a man of the field and of the hunting, and he was typically just a humanistic individual. The gods of the Edomites are mentioned only once or twice in the Old Testament. Now they did find some altars there around Petra, or whether they built them or others, I don't know. At any rate, they dwelt in that particular country. Now they became rather wealthy people because of that trade. You see, the trade that would come from down here in Arabia, come up through here in this way. Well, they would, or if they were going over here down to Egypt, they would charge them toll passing through their land. Then not only that, if it was a small caravan, they were not averse to robbing it and taking all of that. And so they became a very proud people. And so God's going to condemn them on two bases. He's going to judge them on the basis of their pride, and then second, on their cruelty to their brother Jacob. For they had been, and we're going to look at that when we come to the book. So this little book, though short, I think has a great lesson for us. There are two or three lessons in the book. One of the lessons is that pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before fall. The pride of thy heart deceived thee. O thou that dwellest in the cleft of the rock, who settest thy nest on high, that saith in thy heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? God's answer is, O thou mount on high as the eagle, though thy nest be set among the stars, I will bring thee down from thence, saith Jehovah. So pride goeth before destruction. And then to cruelty will always bring about its consequence. Another lesson taught in this little book is that as one sows, a nation sows, so is it going to reap. Well, we can learn a lesson from that. So there are several lessons that we will learn. And another one is that Edom is going to be completely destroyed. They are going to be passed from the scene of history, whereas Jacob will be exalted. Jacob will be exalted in Mount Zion. Of course, that would be in the Messiah, in the Christ. So I think there are a number of lessons that we can get from this. Now look at the history of the Edomites for just a moment. From that kind of a people, about, a couple of hundred years before Christ or something like that, they were driven out, maybe a little earlier. They were driven out of this, from this country here, and here was coming down over here. Here was Judah. Now they were driven out by a tribe or a people called the Nabataeans or Nabataeans, I think it's Nabataeans. But they came in from over here and drove the Edomites out and drove them up here, just south of Judah. So rise up against her in battle. We have heard. Now, whether that means that the prophet Obadiah is identifying himself with the people, and we as a people have heard it, or whether he's identifying himself with other prophets is unknown. But when he says we, well, that always includes more than the individual. So it's either the prophet and the people who've heard this, or the prophet and other prophets who are unknown. But now notice here the ambassador, that is, in this vision, he sees an ambassador going among the people. So it's a vision. Whether a literal ambassador went about, I don't know how that took place. We're not told. But in the vision, he sees an ambassador going among the nations, getting the people together against the Edomite to destroy them. Well, of course, that vision is a symbol of God gathering together those that will destroy the Edomites. Behold, I have made thee small among the nations. Thou art greatly despised. That's Jehovah speaking. Among all the nations of the day, he was small, yes. But now they become despised by the people round about. Now here's what I quoted a moment ago. This to me, one of the most beautiful, majestic statements almost anywhere in literature. One thing about the prophets, not only are the prophets great from the viewpoint of what they deal with, but they're always great from a literary point of view. You'll find some of the greatest and most beautiful statements among in the prophets, as well as the Psalms, or the prophets and Psalms, to be found in any literature. Now, I love this passage. The pride of thy heart had deceived thee, O thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, and saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Now here's God's answer. Though thou mount on high as the eagle, though thy nest be set among the stars, I will bring thee down from thence, saith Jehovah. Beautiful, majestic. Right, now this is the land of Petra. You heard, I think it was about 1955, a good many years ago, one of the editions of the National Geographic were devoted to the Edomites and to Petra. You go into Petra, you come up to a little narrow gorge here, where after a while only one or two horses can come by the side of each other, about 200 or 300 feet high. Just an ideal place to protect a people. Now to come through that, and that's into what we call Petra, where all of those, now that was done by the Nabataeans, not the Edomites. All of those buildings carved out of the sandstone cliff there. You've seen the pictures of Petra, I know. I'm sure you have. And beautiful different colored sands in there. And then they built their treasury there. And there's another place or two, but that was done by the Nabataeans. And so, but it was in the rock. And they trusted in the place where they were for their protection. Right? And so God says, if you built your nest in the clefts of the rock, and you say, who can bring me down to the ground? God said, I will. I'll bring you down. So it's a beautiful picture there of a nation in its pride who boasts of itself because of its setting, and high as the eagle's nest, it can't be touched, and yet God says, I'll bring you down from thence. So God rules in the kingdom of men. Remember that. God determines the appointed seasons and the bounds of the habitation, Paul said in Acts the 17th chapter. If thieves, now notice, now here's a completeness of the destruction. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Parenthetical statement. Would they not steal only till they had enough? if grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some gleaning grapes? Well, yes, a thief comes in, he wouldn't take everything. There's some things he wouldn't want. He'd leave them. And here he gathers grapes. He doesn't look under every leaf to get every grape. He just gets the clusters and gets on out of the vineyard. But now then God says, you won't even have anything left when I get through with you. There won't even be a few grapes left under the leaves, as it were, in this illustration. How are the things of Esau searched? They're going to search out everything you have. How are his hidden treasures sought out? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee on thy way even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread lay a snare unto thee. There is no understanding in him. That means that those who are confederate with you, why, they will turn against you. Those individuals who traded with you for their bread, they're going to turn against you. In other words, you'll find yourself after a while without an ally. You'll be all alone and the nation will be against you. I'm wondering if that won't happen to this country someday. We have tried to help every nation get on its feet, and I don't know that we've got a friend among any of them. There may be. But what do they want? They want what we've got. Most all of them would like to come to this country, not because of our spiritual, what was once our spiritual values and power, because of the material aspect of it. But these, so many of these nations now that we helped to build after the war and gave so much to, they wouldn't give a dime for us. When they get through getting what they can out of us, where are we going to be? I think we'll eventually stand just like these people stand alone. Now, my point is that God in his providence is able to bring about that which he says here, and pride is deceptive. The pride of thy heart deceived thee. Lord before destruction, haughty spirit before fall. All right? And so all of your allies are going to turn against you here, and those that come in to rob you are going to take everything you have. They that ate your bread will set a snare under you. Shall I not in that day, saith Jehovah, destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? Thy mighty men, O Teman, that's one of the southern cities, and at one time was a capital, shall be dismayed to the end that every one may be cut off from the mount of Esau by slaughter. All right, now look at that now. God said, I'll destroy your wise men. I'll destroy the wisdom among you. He said that of another nation or two, that he would destroy the wisdom, the wise men among them. How many wise politicians do we have today? I don't think we got any. I think God has taken away the wisdom and the judgment of this people. Of course, the people are themselves responsible because they set their mind on rejecting God and ruling him out, and on wealth and money and all of that, and the humanistic, hedonistic philosophy that we're following today destroys wisdom. So I really, when these, which are the politicians that know how to handle a situation today? What are they going to do about it? Here we are in an economic crisis. Here we are in other crises. Now, in our educational crisis. And you can go and you take the whole thing. Who's wise enough to tell us how to come out of this? Just as long as they leave God out of their thinking, then not a one of them got any sense. When a person rejects God and the wisdom of God and God's ways, then he's at sea without a compass. You can look at it like you want to, but I want to tell you, we're in a bad shape today. Most of it looking at economically, and I know that, but it's worse than that. Our moral standards, our homes, our school system, our atheistic concept of life, our evolutionary concept, everything on the television, talking about evolution. Gordon was listening to some preacher this morning before we left there for a moment, denying the virgin birth and all that. He's supposed to be a spiritual leader among people. No wisdom. All right, that's what you got back yonder. So we can learn a lesson, can't we? No, we can read the lesson. I don't know whether we'll learn it or not. We can read it, but will we learn it? Whole Teman shall be dismayed. For the violence, now here's the second reason. The first one up there was your pride. Here the second is your violence. For the violence done to thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. Now in the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that strangers carried away his substance, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. Another lesson. When an individual takes, he may not rob plunder, but when he stands on the other side with the enemies of God, he is as one of them. Now here's a reason why I think that this is early, rather than in the days of the Babylonian captivity or invasion there, for the Babylonian didn't do all this to them. But in 2 Chronicles, the 21st chapter, I believe it is, here's a time when you have this kind of experience here. Here in verse 16, and Jehovah stirred up against Jehoram, that was Jehoram, the spirit of the Philistines and of the Arabians that are beside the Ethiopians, and they came up against Judah and brake some of the everybody else there. Alright? Now he moves on here. But look not thou on the day of thy brother in the day of his disaster, and rejoice not over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, neither speak proudly in the day of distress. You've got three thoughts there. That is, I hear disaster, and hear destruction, hear distress. Now don't rejoice in that. I don't think we ought to rejoice in the destruction of anybody. I couldn't rejoice in the fact that some 200,000 Arabs were killed by the Americans during that war. That last estimate I saw, it estimated about 200,000. Nobody knows exactly the number. But sure, when you're going to win a war, going to win it. That's right. If you're going to fight a war, go win it. But I can't rejoice in the destruction of so many people. I just can't do that. And yet sometimes we feel, well, that's what they had coming to them, and maybe so. But I don't find there's something to rejoice in that particular thing. All right? Now, he said, when Judah was suffering this condition here, and proudly in the day of distress, now enter not into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, look not thou on their affliction in the day of their calamity, neither lay ye hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. Now he mentioned calamity three times. There are three other words up there. He had disaster, destruction, and distress. All of that sums up this disaster. It comes unto it. So now then, you may not engage in the battle, but you're willing to go in and lay your hands on the substance when calamity comes too. So there's never anything to rejoice in. Sometimes we hear a preacher or somebody, and well, we're kind of, he was a little proud and arrogant, and we rejoice in what happened to him. No, we can't do that. We just can't rejoice ever. Even as God says in one of the Proverbs somewhere back there, don't rejoice in the calamity of the enemy, even when the enemy is destroyed. We don't want to rejoice in that, because they're human beings, creatures of God, maybe wicked, miss God's judgment, so let him do it, but let us at least feel sorry enough to try to do something about it. All right, now, so enter not, now, I read that, lay hands on them, there, that calamity. Now notice, brother, and stand thou not in the crossway to cut off those of his that escape, and deliver not up those of his that remain in the day of distress. Now, another reason why I think that this is early, back in the first chapter of Amos, which we'll study later on, here he says here, as he pronounced it against power and attire here, where he said, for you turn away, you deliver up the whole people to Edom there. Then that's in verse 10, verse 11, and for three transgressions of Edom, yea, for four I will turn away, because he did pursue his brother with a sword to cast off all pity against him there. Well, this was 755, a long time before the Babylonian captivity, so I think it was then. You also have another one up here, when at Damascus, I believe it is, or one of them here that they, it's Gaza in verse 6. Yea, for four I will not turn away the punishment because they carried away, they captured the whole people to deliver them up to Edom. So here was Edom, that is here the people of Gaza, and the people here of this other one down here, the people of Tyre, they were taking whole villages, and they were selling them to the Edomites, who were selling them into slavery. And this was back in 755, so this is something they'd been doing already before that time, you see. That's why we think we can put this book back earlier, as if it made any difference. Somebody said to me that it never made any difference to him when a book was written. Well, it does to me. I can better understand what he's talking about. If I can get the background of it, then I enter into it better. Well, all right. At any rate here, this is the way they were doing here. And so don't you stand in the way then and cut them off or slay them if they're trying to escape. So evidently they had done that. Now, that's his condemnation of Edom. Now, next he turns to the Jews and God's blessings upon them. So you see, this is a very, when you study things like that and see what God's attitude is, what God does, I think that can help us to understand what God is going to do today. God says, I, Jehovah, change not. If God doesn't change, and Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, then if that be so, then on whatever the basis of whatever principle God dealt with nations in ancient times, he's going to deal with them on the same basic principle today. So when a nation today becomes proud, arrogant, like the Edomites did, when they became cruel, like many of those Arabic peoples are, then God's going to judge them. I am convinced that God's use of America was his judgment against those people that they were fighting. But I think that there will eventually be a judgment against us. See, God's judgments upon pride, upon cruelty, upon these things, or the ignoring of his law. And you take when the Jews crucified Christ and said his blood be upon us and upon our children, well, 35 or 7 years later, while that blood was poured out in Jerusalem now by the Romans, the streets ran with blood, they said. Right? But what was that? That was the execution of God's law against capital punishment. Or rather, that's against the murder and the things they've done in the city. And they murdered the Christ, so now then here is your judgment. And so it is with us. Someday, the blood of the murdered of this country, which murderers were turned loose, the blood of these murderers is going to be washed out by the blood of those that allowed it. And you listen to these radio television fellas, all of them against capital punishment. That ACLU outfit is one of the dominant people against it, but all the rest of them the same thing. No capital punishment, no capital, we're all against it. Our state here is against it and all that. God ordained it. And they that shed, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he him, or made he man. So when a man killed a man, he destroyed something that was made originally in God's image. Now God said, but man shall his blood be shed. Now they're saying, what did that fellow say the other day? Gordon was telling about it. He watched a lot more television than I do. I don't watch much of it. But he was telling me about this fellow that said, now whoever pulled the trigger is guilty of a killing as the fellow that he put him to death. Well, that's a lie. I don't want any truth in that. He doesn't know his Bible. He doesn't know common sense. That's the kind of people we got here trying to run this country. I've got enough common sense to know the difference between a murderer and one who and the penalty executed for what he does. You can say the same thing of a fellow, of a judge that sends a man to prison for 10 years for stealing. You can say he's as guilty of stealing as the fellow he's sending to jail for it. If not, why not? They can't have a law without a penalty for its violation. You think about that. You can't have a law without a death chamber. If he's guilty, I'd say yes. Send him to the death chamber. I don't want to pull the trigger because it's the truth. I'm not in that business. But if I were in that business, if I wanted to run for that kind of an office or hold it, I'd be no more guilty than the jury that found him guilty. No more. Well, there's a lesson we learn from the prophets. We learn this lesson. Now note, but in Mount Zion there shall be those that escape. No, wait a minute. Verse 15. For the day of Jehovah. Now that expression, you'll find it, is always a day of judgment against wickedness and of deliverance for those that do right. The day of Jehovah, the day of the Lord, is always a day of judgment for one group and of deliverance for another. It is near upon all the nations, as thou hast done. Now here's your idea there of sowing and reaping. As thou hast done, it should be done unto thee. Thy dealing shall be returned upon thine own head. All right, same thing with us. As we have dealt, so it's going to be dealt unto us. As we are living today, that's going to come back on us. For as you have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. Yea, they shall drink and swallow down, and shall be as though they had not been. They'll be swept away. That is, whether they actually did that literally on the temple ground, or whether it was that you treated my law like that. It doesn't matter. Same thing. But in Mount Zion there shall be those that escape. Now there's the place of escape. And it shall be holy. And the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. That is, they're going to be victorious. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau a stubble. And they shall burn among them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining to the house of Esau, for Jehovah has spoken it. Now they're going to be brought to naught, but in Zion there'll be those that escape. So here then, when God pronounces a judgment upon one people here, up here's another people where there is a place of escape. So Zion is always, that's the fortress of God, place of escape where God was there. Now when God left over in Ezekiel, you remember that 11th chapter, when there you saw the chariot of Jehovah rise up over the temple ground, and then move over to the east, symbolic of Jehovah, leaving Jerusalem, leaving the temple. Therefore it was destroyed. Yeah, up till then it had been God's dwelling place. They thought it couldn't be destroyed because it was God's dwelling place. No, when they did like that, God left it. Jesus said in Matthew 23 and verse 36, 7, 8 there, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Right? When Jesus left the house desolate, what happened to it? A few years later, the Romans completely destroyed it and cast it down because it was desolate. An abomination in the sight of God because of what it was. Abomination of the desolate there, brought to an end. Well, all right, those are great lessons to teach us about God. Right, and so that's what will happen now. And they of the south, that's the Negev, shall possess the mount of Esau, and they of the lowland, the Philistines, and they shall possess the field of Ephraim and the field of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead, and the captives of this host of the children of Israel that are among the Canaanites shall possess even unto Zarephath to the north, and the captives of Jerusalem that are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the south, and saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Jehovah's. I think that's definitely messianic. Saviors shall come. Now, that doesn't mean there'll be more than one. That requires to the savior, but the individual who preached that salvation, that'd be the apostles, that'd be the evangelists, and here, and we're going to come back to this when I come to
to Amos, the last chapter of Amos, we'll come back to this and identify this with what Amos said maybe 100 years later there, and show that he's talking there about those whom God will raise up to bring the message of salvation. But where will he come from? Isaiah said, out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. So it's from here that the saviors are going to go out here, all directions here, wherever it might be. Saviors are going to carry the message there, but the salvation is in Zion. It's in God's holy city there. The writer of Hebrews said that. You have come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God, unto the heavenly Jerusalem, unto an innumerable host of angels, the general assembly church and firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the blood of Jesus that speaketh better than that of Abel, and so on. Hebrews the 12th chapter. That's what we've come unto. For the salvation is in God's holy city, the city of Zion. Now, I mentioned this a while back. We sing that song. It's a lovely song. I'm marching on to Zion. But really, I think scripturally, we've already reached that. The saints are in Zion. You've come unto Mount Zion, the writer of Hebrews says. And here in Revelation 14:1, is Christ on the Mount Zion, and the 144,000 that follow him, who've been redeemed, who follow him wherever he goes, those are saints, 144,000. Now, he tells us who they are. They are saints who have come unto Mount Zion, unto Jesus, the heavenly Jerusalem. So, but we generally think about it talking about heaven. When we sing the song, we're all marching to heaven, and that is correct. But we actually have come unto Mount Zion, the heaven of Jerusalem, and unto Jesus there, the mediator. Let me just read those passages. I pull my timers up here. I think I've quoted them correctly. But let's just notice there in the 12th chapter of Hebrews there, what he says in that, you've come here to Mount Zion, and down about verse, 22. But you have come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heaven of Jerusalem, and to innumerable hosts of angels, to the general assembly, and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, to God the judge of all and so on. That's what you come to. Now looking over here to the 14th chapter, I believe my 14th chapter is gone. Yeah. I've got another one, I should have brought it. Go ahead and turn to 14th chapter and verse 1 of Revelation. 14th chapter of Revelation. All right, now that's a description of the saints who have come unto Mount Zion, who are following the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. So we can sing the song, all right, but I like for us to know really what the truth is when we sing a song like that. When we're talking about we're on our way to heaven, but that's really, we've come to Zion, we've come unto the Mount, we've come unto Jesus, and now then, who are the 144,000? It's the full, complete number, spiritual, religious number of all of those who have been purchased, who follow him, and whose mouth is no lie, that speak the truth, and so on there. All right. So when we look at these saviors going out of Zion, their salvation is in Zion with the Lord there. So I think that this book then, the latter part of it, is messianic, and fulfilled under Christ in the Messiah. Well, we'll stop there. Now, next time, our next book, it will be Joel. Here, Obadiah, Joel, and Jonah. Those are the first three. So next time, we'll give a little background of Jonah, and its message is also one of judgment against sin. So many of these prophets, they were, well, I should have said when I started, three things we'll look for. We look for the condition under which they were prophesying and how they met it. Look at second, God and the political nations of the world. And third, since all these are going to be destroyed, is anything permanent? Yes. Then there's going to be a spiritual kingdom set up with a spiritual king that will never be destroyed. Those are the three things we're going to emphasize. We'll go through them. Or the classics, excuse me.